The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, I'm Laura Bennett, the editorial director of Slate, and I am so excited to be hosting this season of Working. We are going to be focusing on the New York Comedy Club and cultural institution Comedy Cellar, which was founded in 1982 and has since been the starting ground for comedians like Chris Rock and Jon Stewart and Sarah Silverman and many, many others. This season, we'll be focusing on how the people of Comedy Cellar work, from rookie comedians just beginning to test out their own material at the club, to the comedians who've been fixtures there forever, to the behind-the-scenes staffers like its legendary Booker. We will start with Noam Dorman, who has owned Comedy Cellar since 2003 when he inherited it after his father's death and currently runs the place. One thing we do touch on in this interview, and one reason you might actually have heard Noam's name recently in the news, is that Louis C.K., who also got his start at the Cellar, did a surprise set there a few months ago in the wake of the sexual harassment allegations against him, and that made a lot of people very angry. Since this season is so anchored in a particular place, we are doing our interviews at the Comedy Cellar itself. Well, specifically, we are at the Olive Tree Cafe next door to the Comedy Cellar, which is part of the same building and functionally the club's backstage, or upstage, if you will. And that's why you're going to hear some restaurant-y background noise, and also why sometimes the people we're interviewing might pause to say hey to someone who's passing by. Hope you enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp's software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
What's your name and what do you do?
My name is Noam Dorman. I'm the owner of the Comedy Cellar.
So, if I'm not mistaken, you inherited the Comedy Cellar from your dad in 2003?
2003.
Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Take me back to that. So, what was it like to inherit this from your dad? Did you grow up in the Comedy Cellar?
Well, the Comedy Cellar opened in 81, which was the year I was already at college. So, I didn't grow up in it. And then, most of my adult life, I had been a musician. I owned the Cafe Wa next door and the Village Underground around the corner. And then I was playing music 5-6 nights a week. So then when my father died, I inherited it originally with his wife, kind of like my stepmother. She's the one who did all these paintings and stuff on the wall. And then I didn't really want to run it. And it just, then I only had a couple years left on our lease next door on the Wa, and the landlord died, and I wasn't sure I was going to get another lease or not. And I kind of had to make a decision where to throw my future in. And I threw in with the Comedy Cellar because we own the building here. So that's really how I ended up doing it. So I ended up selling the Cafe Wa and just devoting myself to comedy. And then I eventually bought out my father's wife.
Why did you think at first you didn't want to run it?
Because, like, in the Cafe Wa, I was in charge of the band and I was performing. And it was actually, at the time, much more successful than the Comedy Cellar. That was the place that had lines every night to come in. And this was my father's thing. It wasn't really something that I... And there's two layers to it. One, it was my father's thing. And then the other thing is that in the end, it's the comedians who are the real creative forces in the place. So to some extent, there's just this feeling that, I kind of put the lights on and give them a microphone. But that is not a huge accomplishment of my own.
Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm not being falsely humble. I understand we do it. We do many things better than the other clubs do. And I don't believe that it's luck that we're, kind of doing so well. But yes, I do feel that way, yeah.
So were you interested in comedy when you were growing up? Was it, I mean, your dad obviously
was. I had a normal interest that kids, you know, my generation was the generation where Saturday Night Live came out and Steve Martin was at the, you know, the height of his fame, wild and crazy guy, right at the, you know, when I was exactly the age for that.
And so you weren't like a comedy head.
No, it wasn't like Judd Apatow. You know, the story is that Judd Apatow would sit home and transcribe Saturday Night Live sketches. Because,
that wasn't what you were doing.
Because he figured he would never get to hear them again. Because it was like in those days, there was no, you couldn't even record it. Or they just had VCRs kind of coming out then. So
how did your dad get into this in the first place?
So he had, we had the room downstairs, which was not really doing much. It was trying this and trying that. And this guy named Bill Grundfest, who later went on to become the, I think, the head writer of Mad About You with Paul Reiser. He came in and he suggested to my father that he could bring comedy down here. It was like a typical deal where he would keep the door and we would take the food and the drinks, and that's how it started.
So did you see your dad over the course of his life get more into comedy as he got deeper into this world?
Yeah, he became really involved with it, mostly in the personal relationships with all the comedians that he developed. That was very, very important to him. And he died of cancer, and he had like a, it's like in the hospital for like 6 weeks or something. And a lot of conversations we had at that time. And one of the things he told me was that this, and my father had a lot of other big successes in his life, but that the last 10 years of his life was the happiest time of his life.
Because of The Cellar?
Yeah, because of The Cellar and because of how he enjoyed the comedians.
What about it made it so happy? What did he love about this place?
He loved hanging out with the comedians.
Do you love it too?
I love it. I don't think I love it as much as he did. That might just be that the Comedy Cellar in those days was smaller and the group of comedians was smaller. So it was just all a little bit more intimate. And then it might also have something to do with the differences in our personalities. Well, also, I'm much younger than he was at the time. So now I have a family. I have three kids at home. And every minute I spend here is at the expense of, in some way, spending time with my kids or not getting up in the morning with my kids, where he was already an empty nester and nothing else was competing for his time. So he could just hang out, you know, without any worry.
So tell me about the early years of running this place when you first inherited it. You have no, your musician background, but you don't really have experience in comedy. What were those early years like?
I was always semi-involved in the place. It wasn't like I just walked in and didn't know what was going on. And in many ways, it's just much easier than what I was doing at the Café Wa. Because, like I said, the most important and the most difficult part of the product that we're selling is done by the comedians. So that really makes it much, much easier. In the same way that when you're owning a bar is much easier than a restaurant, because Jack Daniels makes sure that the liquor in the bottle comes out good. When you own a restaurant, you have to prepare the food. And that's way harder. When you have a bar, you just have to make sure the atmosphere is nice. And again, that's a huge challenge in and of itself.
So tell me about the basics of your job running this place. What does it mean? What do you have to do?
I oversee everything. I have a general manager now, and had for the last 5 or 6 years, who is fantastic. And I never had that before. So a lot of the things that I used to really worry about keeping tabs on, she's taken off my plate. But I do oversee the booking every week with Esty. And again, Esty's been doing it for, you know, 30 years. So a lot of times I just rubber stamp it.
When you have some kind of objection, what's the basis of it usually?
The objection might be, first of all, it could just be something that she overlooked. It might be that I saw someone I didn't think they were doing well. Or it might be that I think that there's too many consecutive comedians that either don't have a high enough certainty in terms of how they'll go over, or they might not have a high energy comedian as quickly as I feel we need to have one. That's the usual kind of thing.
Who are some of the comedians you have the highest certainty level that they're just going to kill it every time now?
I think like Greer Barnes. I mean, he always kills. Joe Mackey, Sam Morrell. There's a lot of really, really good comedians.
How long have you been doing this? How many years has it been? Because I haven't done the math.
16 years.
So the comedy world has changed a lot over the course of those years. How has your job changed along with the rise of social media, with a sort of ongoing simmering conversation about political correctness, with, you know, an age in which comedians can so quickly become radioactive? How does all that affect your job?
Well, last year we had this, you know, really horrible, traumatic year because when Louis C.K. was dropping in, and we got a lot of social media abuse about it, including threats of violence and things like that.
What's the aftermath of that been like for you?
And now that we're looking at it in the rearview mirror, it's not clear to me where real life ends and where the perception of real life as seen through Twitter begins, because we were very, very worried about how it was going to impact our business, but we're okay.
Was there a dip at all? Did you sense any impact in your business?
I don't think there was a dip. I don't think there was.
And you've talked a little bit about how you have a new policy that people can walk out in the middle of a performance if they object to whoever is on stage. First of all, have people availed themselves of that policy?
Yeah.
And how do you feel about it? I mean, is it working out?
I was happy that they did rather than be pissed off or whatever. I thought it worked nicely. I mean, that cost us money, you know, but whatever. So, yeah, I think it worked well. It was interesting that, like, if Louis would come in and close the show, we would have a table or two might walk out. Meaning, like, kind of they'd already seen the show they came to see, and they're like, let's get out of here. If he went on, like, third, almost nobody would walk out. They would stick it out if they still wanted more comedians afterwards.
So did you start strategizing about where to slot him in the
no,
lineup?
No. I actually preferred if he would come in at the end, because I was just, the worst part about it was having unhappy customers. And anything I could do that people wouldn't be unhappy was what I wanted to do. So
during that whole flare-up, how did you, I mean, did you lose sleep over it? Do you bring that stuff home with you? What was your life like during that?
Because, you know, the press would write just the most outrageous and untrue things. I mean, I really learned this firsthand. And they would take things out of context. They would gut my point in some way. You know, it was very, very disturbing to see that. Very, very disturbing.
Had you ever in your career had a stint like that that was as stressful in the same way when the Louis stuff happened?
No, that was the scariest thing I've been through. I mean, in one hand, you know, it's like everybody should have my problems. That should be the worst thing that they should go through. is you know, but I had never been through anything stressful like that where I thought I could lose my livelihood.
Did you ever think you were going to have to shut down the place, or what was the most dramatic outcome that occurred to you?
I didn't think I would have to shut it down, but I thought that we could. I mean, I asked my wife, I said, well, what happens if this really, you know, affects our standard of living? And God bless her. She's like, I've had less before. Like, she grew up like in poor in Brooklyn. She's like, I've had less before. So, which was a huge thing for me, because you can imagine having a wife, you're going through all the stress, and then your wife is like angry at you about it. It would become impossible to live that way. But she was very, very supportive.
So if Louis showed up tonight, you let him on?
Yeah. Well, we have this swim at your own risk policy, and we'd put him on if he wants to go on. But I think it's calmed down because he's been touring comedy clubs all over the country now. So I feel like we're no longer doing something noteworthy. I think all but one club, Comedy Works in Colorado, I think all but one club has been putting him on. So, you know.
During the peak of all this stuff, did you start thinking about having to, like, scratch certain comedians' names off the marquee, if that was going to help with the bottom line? Aziz, for instance, is somebody who, you know, it's a very different situation what happened with him. But, like, was there ever a moment when you thought that you were going to lose customers, so you were going to have to start keeping people like Aziz off your stage?
It never got to that. But I did have to ask myself, at what point would I buckle, you know?
And what was the answer to yourself when you asked that question?
But I was ready to go to the mat. I was ready to take a lot of pain because I felt it would pass and that I was doing the right thing. It's not about how I felt about what anybody's done or hasn't done in their lives. I didn't want to become part of the mob. I didn't want to do that. We have all kinds of procedures and institutions and mechanisms to mete out punishment. And I didn't want to be called on 15 years after some fact that I read a paragraph about in a newspaper and decide that, oh, this person can work and this person can't. And I mean, I'm going through the whole thing, but like one of the arguments I had with Ted Alexandro, who was a comedian who was pretty publicly opposed to what I did. And I said, Ted, if we were sitting at the table having coffee and you confessed to me something that you did 15 years ago that you were ashamed of, would you expect me to throw you out? And I really felt strong. Like, this is just because everybody's looking. The fact is, we all know people who've done things 15 years ago that they should be ashamed of, and nobody thinks that their boss should find out and fire them. So, right or wrong, that's what I felt, and I did not want to become part of the mob.
Right. I don't feel like we need here to, you know, obviously, like, relitigate the rightness or wrongness of that decision, but I am interested in how practically it's changed how you do your job every day, and whether you feel like it's something that's still a bug in your mind as you're looking at Estee's lineups or as you're...
I stubbornly try to avoid absolutely as much as I can all those pressures and just choose the best show, because I really feel that once I start down that road, it becomes impossible to not become a hypocrite. It's impossible to start separating my personal feelings. And you know, I judged this one, but then I found out that this guy did something similar, but nobody knows about it, but he's my friend, and this one I don't. I just want to call it balls and strikes and do it in good faith. And that, because in the end, the audience wants to see the best show, period.
Is it as important to you to have relationships with comedians as it was to your dad? Do you have those personal relationships?
Very important. And I have a lot of personal relationships. And by the way, it was tricky with the thing with Louis, because not every comedian was happy with the decision. And some comedians didn't want to go on the show with him. And some comedians, so, you know, it was a lot of fancy footwork and a lot of sensitive politics I had to play.
Right.
And that was scary too.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. How long did it take you, well, first of all, to just get good at your job, to get good at running this place, and to figure out what makes a really good night here, like a really good lineup?
Yeah, I think I was always good at it, to be honest. I think that that's something that I inherited from my father. I think I always had a natural sense for it, whether in music or in comedy. And I think that the job is, one of the hardest things about the job is not getting too enamored with yourself. I think that it's pretty obvious to everybody. I mean, to everybody, who is getting laughs and who's not. And I know that some club owners and some bookers see themselves as, to use the word, the curators, you know. And
they're, you don't see yourself as a curator?
No, and they're going to try to teach the public their more sophisticated taste about what's funny and what's not funny. And I have my own taste about what's funny and not funny, but I think that's an egotistical mistake, and I think it's not a formula for success.
So when someone's jokes are just bombing night after night, and you know, they're maybe they're a friend of yours, there's someone who's a friend of the house, is there a protocol by which you say, man, you gotta stop coming?
We give them fewer spots. And I mean, they know when they're not going over, you know. It's difficult sometimes, especially the more common thing is when somebody's been doing it for a very long time and they kind of, they all go into ruts at certain times, kind of like the way authors have writer's block, this kind of thing.
Do you feel like it's part of your job to tell someone when they're in a rut?
No, I don't tell them.
They know?
No, I don't tell them. I mean, somebody asks me, if it's one of the very few comedians that I have good friendships with almost all of them, but there's only a small number that are intimate friends. And if an intimate friend were to ask me, you know, for an honest opinion, 50-50, I might give it to them. But I try not to. They don't want to hear it from me.
Have you ever tried stand-up yourself?
No.
Would you ever do it?
No, I and
what
it's
would
not,
it take to get you on stage? Well, like
and the thing
minutes.
Is, I am kind of funny, but there's another element of being a stand-up comic, which is not simply being funny, and that's the my father says a compulsion to do it, to perform it, and to be on stage doing it, and I don't have that. And
you mean to like get off on the response in the room and to really
they
like,
live yeah. for their sets. Now, and listen, I, hey Joe, I've been, you know, surrounded by musicians all my life, and they love to play. Their love of the stage is nothing compared to comedians. These comedians, I mean, they will go all over town. Most clubs barely, we pay the best. Most clubs barely even pay. And there's free spots, there's bar shows all over town. They will go all over town for 5-minute spots in crappy rooms just to get on stage.
Why do you think that is? So how is the relationship between musicians and their craft different from the relationship between comedians and their craft?
Well, the obvious part is that you can play music at home and quite affectingly and get a lot of satisfaction out of playing beautifully all by yourself or recording something, you know. So you don't need the audience for that. Where actually comedy doesn't exist without the audience. So they have to have that. But then on top of that, there just seems to be something about their personalities that require or seek this particular source of approval out. Or whatever it is. I mean, I hope I don't sound like I'm disparaging, and
no.
I'm not. It's just, they're a unique breed. They know that they're a unique breed. That's why they only like to hang out with each other.
Do you like hanging out with comedians?
I love to hang out with a comedian, yeah. First of all, they're funny. And you also can say whatever you want around them. You don't have to worry about saying the wrong thing. It's not like Thanksgiving dinner at your mother-in-law's house, where it looks at you like you're crazy. Like, did you just say that?
So there are no sensitive, thin-skinned comedians?
I can't say there are none, but it's it's not something one worries about. I mean, obviously, you can't. If you have some, like, hateful, racist opinion, that won't fly. But presuming you're not, you know, a Nazi, but yeah, you can say whatever you want. You can make whatever jokes you want. You could even discuss politics in a very blunt and politically incorrect way, and everybody's fine with it.
Why do you think the cellar looms so large in the cultural imagination?
I don't know. I think that much of what goes on here is not about the comedy. And it's, you know, it's been a lot of, you ask me what I do during the day. A lot of what I do during the day is I'm reading emails from customers who complained about things. I'm following up on those complaints. We send an email to every customer after the show, asking for their feedback.
Do you read all the complaints that come into the inbox?
All of them, and I answer them all myself. And then I follow up, and like I think tomorrow we're having a meeting with a waiter who a customer complained about, you know, of course,
there's
always
complaint about like rude treatment or something.
He complained that the waiter was short with him and he had trouble getting a drink. The point being that I don't know that the other clubs are into the customer service business in any kind of serious way. Maybe they are, but you know, when I've gone to them, it hasn't felt that way. And I think that's a big part of the reason people come here. And it rubs off because it's also part of the reason that the comedians like to come here, because we're good hosts to the comedians too. We try to treat them the way we'd like to be treated ourselves. And so it's a warm environment and they like to hang out here. So it all feeds on itself.
Was there a moment when it kind of clicked for you, when you were like, I can run this thing? I know what I'm doing here?
No, I didn't lack the confidence to run the place. I didn't expect it to grow as it did. And I made, you know, decisions one after another, like expanding and opening around the corner and, you know, various aesthetic decisions of building the room and whatever decisions I made with the various TV shows that have come in here, and now we have Comedy Central show, all these things, and they all, for the most part, have been working nicely.
What do you think is the biggest mistake you've made running this place in all of the years?
It's going to sound egotistical if I don't. I think they asked President Bush one time that same question, and he didn't cop to a mistake, and he got a lot of blowback for it.
You got to cop to a mistake. It can't be one of those like job interview self-flattering mistakes. It's got to be a bona fide mistake.
The biggest mistake I've made, it might have been opening in Las Vegas, even though it's going pretty well, but it's a lot of extra stress and work.
Do you get bored of listening to comedy night after night after night?
I don't listen to it night after night.
So you don't sit there and you listen to it?
No, I don't.
So what are you doing when people are on stage?
I mean, sometimes I go down and watch. And sometimes I'm just sitting at the back table with the comedians. And sometimes, you know, we have a whole nother world that's sprung up here in the Olive Tree now of like a lot of journalists and opinion writers and stuff like that from CNN and Slate and The Times. They hang out here now. And I like to, you know, because I went to law school, so I have that interest too. So I spend a lot of time just, you know, yapping about politics with people. And that's I enjoy that too. Okay, just get back. I can't really identify any big mistake I made. I will tell you that my biggest worry is that I'm not on top of things like I used to be. Things like the consistency of the food and things like that, which seem to be going okay, but I know if my father were alive, he would be disapproving that I'm not.
He would be like sampling the fries and being like, these aren't good enough.
Yeah. And you know,
he had that level of attention to detail.
Yeah, and I used to do that, you know, and now I farm it out a little bit. And part of it is because I have three kids now, and part of it is because the comedians are such a big part of the thing now that it's kind of a little less important what goes on in the restaurant. But as a matter of personal pride, yeah, I need to worry about the French fries, every order of French fries. So that worries me.
So when you're helping Estee put together a lineup, what are you looking for? Like, what kind of combination of personalities makes a really good lineup?
Yeah, and I don't help her. She puts the whole thing together. But again, we're not reinventing the wheel. It's usually like a strong, upbeat opener. And then the acts which come in the middle, which can go either way. And it doesn't mean they're weaker acts. It's just, you know, it's like fielding a lineup for a baseball team. And then hopefully having someone at the end who can close strong and can close that has a high batting average so that in case anybody else in the middle didn't do that well, at least we know that the last act is certain to kill. Some of the best acts don't always kill. Some of the best acts can be hit or miss.
What is the single most exciting night you've ever had here?
So the most exciting night was probably that night when it was like called $1 billion of comedy by the New York Times, where it was like Dave Attell, Jerry Seinfeld, Aziz, Amy Schumer, Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle, and
I'm
going to forget one other huge name. Whatever. They all came down coincidentally. They all came down on the same night. So that was probably our most exciting.
How many of them were built?
None of them were built. Wow. They just all showed up. Yeah.
That's amazing. What was the atmosphere like in the room that night?
It was like disbelief. Like, you know, we get a lot of people here who are like hardcore comedy fans. Like, we're kind of the place where the comedy aficionados will come. So it's like you're at a club somewhere to see some new music band, and all of a sudden the Stones show up, and then if that wasn't gonna, then all of a sudden Paul McCartney shows up, and then all of a sudden Elton John shows up. Like, the people just they could not believe that all their heroes were showing up like that. A lot of the really, really big names just drop in. And there's kind of a progression, like with Aziz and Amy Schumer and a few of these people, Michelle Wolf. They were here before they were famous, and then they began to become famous, and then at some point it became clear they're just too famous to put on the lineup, you know, because they just start getting these crowds out there.
Yeah, so what do you mean when you say too famous?
Like, right now, if we put Amy Schumer, like, she might be fine going on the lineup. I don't know how she feels.
Would be around
but, like, you know, it'd be like Beatlemania, you know, it'd be like crazy. So we just can't have that. So there's
so
that
even
group
if
of comedians.
You know in advance that Amy Schumer is going to be there, you don't put her on the lineup
because
you don't want Beatlemania.
Yeah, I don't think. I don't know if she'd want to go on the lineup or not, but no, we wouldn't.
So when someone like Schumer comes here at this point, are they testing out new material? Or are they just like scratching an itch? Like, what are they in it for?
Yeah, well, it could be anything. They could be testing out new material. They could be practicing material that's already kind of like stamped for approval, but that they're getting ready for like hosting SNL or about getting ready to do an hour special or whatever it is. Or they could just be doing spots for the fun of it. They love to do spots. They love it. So it could be any of those things. And by the way, like somebody like up-and-comers now, like Jared Fried or Andrew Schultz, you know, there's a lot of people now who have huge followings that are totally under the radar if you're not part of their following. That's the multifurcated nature of social media. Like, somebody can have 5 million YouTube hits and you would never heard of them. So there's a lot of these comedians have these really, really big followings that we don't even realize it till we put them on the lineup.
It's so interesting to think there's the sweet spot of someone who's famous enough, like Michael Che, for instance, where you know you're going to fill the house, then it'll be, I mean, you probably fill the house every night, do you?
Yeah.
Where it's not a liability to put him on the lineup because it won't be Beatlemania, but it's still like, you know, he'll be really good. Is there a category of person who's like famous enough where you're happy that they're that famous, or?
Yeah, I mean, we get a lot of well-known, like Michael Che, and I think Leslie Jones is on this week, and a lot of those SNL guys, when they do comedy, go on the lineup. There's a lot of really famous people who go on the lineup. Mike Birbiglia goes on the lineup, and I think Judd Apatow goes on the lineup. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so how do you draw the distinctions between who goes on the lineup and who doesn't? Is it just an intuitive thing?
No, we kind of let them decide. There's only so many Aziz's, and there's a few of these comedians who are able to sell out Madison Square Garden. There's a handful of them. And those are the ones.
So does Louis go on the lineup now in order to give people a heads up?
Louis wasn't going on the lineup. Then we tried to put him on the lineup, and that kind of backfired. People complained about that, which I knew they were going to, but I did it anyway, because what happened was that the people who complained about the fact that we were, I'm using scare quotes, surprising the audience with Louis, then were complaining about the fact that we were announcing that Louis was going to go on. So it was really just about Louis. And that's their right, you know. So that didn't work out. So then we went back to just having him do surprise sets. But then it didn't last that long. Then he hasn't been here for like 6-8 months already. He'd just been on tour.
So he hasn't tried to come?
No, he hasn't tried to come.
Are there certain nights you prefer here because there are a few tourists or fewer, more New Yorkers or fewer New Yorkers or whatever? Like, how does this
sort of... this is the fortunate situation we're in now. And I was reluctant to say these things because it sounds like I'm bragging in some way. And I don't mean it that way, but just to answer the question honestly, we're so fortunate now. Basically, every night is the same as every other night. There's no clear busier nights or slower nights. All right, we have 4 shows on Saturday and we only have 3 shows on a Monday. And the rooms, our rooms are not that big. And all the shows are sold out. And quite often, the most famous people will drop in weeknights because they might have gigs and stuff on the weekends. So, no, there's no... I mean, I like to come Friday nights because I play guitar here Friday nights in the Olive Tree. And that's fun, but that's it.
What is the most annoying part of your job?
Honestly, the most annoying part of the job is the day-to-day stuff that every customer service boss has to deal with, like getting the host at the door to not be jaded, to not be short with a customer because they've answered the same question 30 different times.
So do you have to tell them repeatedly, like, you got to be less jaded?
It's really hard. And of course, this is just the nature of being the boss, that everybody kind of circles the wagons to protect employees and their friends and whatever it is. And I had to be the bad guy, and I have to not, I can't accept it. For instance, I go to Disney World. I know they must get a lot of annoying parents, I think, but the people there, they're always nice. And as I say to myself, I say, don't listen to it.
Do you model after Disney World?
I mean, like, if it can be done, then I need to be doing it. And I'm not saying we are doing it. I'm saying that's the most annoying part of my job.
Right. What is the maddest you've ever gotten at a comedian for whatever he or she said on stage?
I got mad at a comedian one time for calling a customer a cunt.
As like an HR issue, when that happens, what do you do? I mean, how do you handle that? Do you talk to the comedian afterward or what?
I called them in for a meeting. They promised never to do it again, and they didn't.
Were they apologetic? Did they realize
yes,
it was Nick?
Yeah,
or were they
yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's my right? Yeah, it's free
no,
speech.
No. They know. They're professionals. They know. Thing is, you can lose your mind on stage, and you can. It's so high pressure, and if you have a bad temper, almost all of them at one time or another have let it get the better of them. Calling somebody the C word, that's like over the top.
So was that, like, what if it was funny? What if it landed as a joke? And then we
No, but it wasn't. It was an anger.
It was an anger.
Yeah. If it was a joke, then I would probably have let it go. Even if somebody got offended. A joke is a joke. But
yeah, isn't that kind of hard to parse, though?
No, this wasn't hard to parse.
No, it's really straightforward.
Yeah, this was the real thing.
What is the most annoying audience member you've ever encountered?
There's not one particular audience member that was annoying, but there's a type of a guy who's drunk, comes in drunk, and can't, sometimes in good faith, is not the best judge of the fact that he's talking loud or whatever it is, and then you have to negotiate with him, and you don't want to be mean, and you don't want to drag him out physically, and you're trying to get him to be quiet. So this is dicey. And it's also the riskiest thing we go through. That is always the scenario which, if you're not careful, can escalate into something that you just didn't see coming, either a fight or, God forbid, there's a place around the corner here, I don't want to say the name, where they threw out a customer who was deserved to be thrown out, and then the customer waited, and then when the bartender left at the end of the night, he shot him.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so like you just never know what you're dealing with when you're dealing with a customer that in some way you humiliate in front of a crowd of people.
So
nevertheless,
how do you handle it? And is it on you to deal with that person?
No, it's on... I mean, the way I like to handle it whenever I can is to have a... This is going to sound sexist. I like to have a waitress, not even a waiter, a waitress, be the first line of interface, because most people will react. They don't mind backing down or listening to a waitress.
So why is that?
That's just something... But what happens is if that doesn't work and then like one of the burly security guys has to come talk to them, now you kind of have a macho thing going on. And just the fact that he's being told something in front of a room of people means he doesn't want to do it, no matter what it is. It's really tough, you know, it's really tough.
Do you go to other comedy clubs?
Yeah, I just went to one a couple days ago, yeah.
So what are the kinds of things you notice that like a normal customer or audience member wouldn't notice?
Every single aspect. I notice the lighting, I notice the quality of the sound, I notice the, for lack of a better word, the happiness of the atmosphere. Like the Comedy Cellar is very warm. It's very, there's like twinkly lights and deep colors and kind of earthy vibes to it. Some of the other clubs can be very sterile or cold or just not a place that you feel nice sitting in.
So when you're going to other clubs, is it for market research or can you really sit back and enjoy the comedy?
I just like to check in and see, to make sure that there's nothing going on that I should know about and I'm doing wrong or whatever it is.
Do you ever notice something specific that's happening that you should be doing that you feel like you're doing wrong?
I did notice one time I went to a club years ago and they had a policy which was the same as our policy. It was about getting, you know, presenting your receipts when you leave. As I was walking out, I didn't have my receipt for some reason, and the guy at the door commanded me to go back to my table and get the receipt. And I didn't like it. I didn't like being told what to do, especially because it wasn't my fault. Like the waiter had... And ever since that, I've been very sensitive to that. And it still rears its ugly head, but I always tell the door guys, somebody forgets their receipts, do not tell them to go back to the table, get the waitress to go back to the table, or just let them go. We'll just risk it.
So you said you don't do stand-up, you have no intentions of doing stand-up, but from being in this business for so long, do you find yourself thinking, oh, that's a joke that I would make if I were on stage?
No.
Secret set?
No. I will give one plug to a comedian, Gary Goldman. You know who Gary Goldman is?
Yeah.
What I do find myself saying with Gary Goldman, as opposed to many of the other comics, I say to myself, if I were a stand-up comic, I could have never thought of that. Like, there's a lot of comedians who, and they're funny ones, who the universe of their jokes are within what I think could be achievable. Like if I see a guitar player who is really good, I say, I could play like that. But then you see someone like Goldman come up with this whole bit about like state abbreviations or his role playing between college professors, whatever, and you say, that's a whole nother level of talent. I could never do that.
What would it be the advice you'd give to someone trying to open a comedy club in 2019?
You know, I get people quite often contacting me about advice like that. And I always tell them they shouldn't do it. It's a bad business? It's not a great business. We do very well now. Are we ready to start?
Well, what time it is? Hey, everybody.
Hello.
I'll wrap it up. Okay. I tell people not to do it. It's a great business for us now. For most of our existence, it was touch and go. Even when we were considered successful, we were always like, how are we going to survive another snowstorm and going into debt and things like that? It's not like, you know, printing money kind of business. And on top of that, if you do it anywhere but in New York City or Los Angeles, you don't have access to the best comedians anyway, or you have a headliner who might be one of the best comedians. So you don't even get the joy of surrounding yourself by this flock of really, really talented, fun people. So you're really becoming a merchant. You could be selling steaks or textiles, or you're selling a dude telling jokes. So I don't know what pleasure someone gets out of that business.
Can you remember the single best joke you've ever heard here?
No, I'm not. I can't remember that.
That's it for this episode of Working. Thank you for listening. Again, I'm your host, Laura Bennett. If you liked the show, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. If you have any questions or comments, you can write us at working@slate.com. Working is produced by Jessamine Molly. Special thanks to Justin D. Wright for the ad music. Come back next week for another episode on New York's Comedy Cellar.
sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.